takes about a half a day to get there if we travel by dragonfly. No, it's not in Spain, but all the same you know it's a goofy name, and the wind's just right.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org live, or you can hear this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Aftershock with Robert Reich. Robert Reich shows that inequality causes the booms and busts that United States has been experiencing. And then, after that, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell speech, where he explains to the nation the military-industrial complex. And then, after that, Timothy McBain interviews William Hartung. William Hartung is a director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation and an expert on weapons proliferation and military spending. He updates us on the state of the current military-industrial complex and comments how companies like Lockheed Martin have exceeded what Eisenhower envisioned when he coined the phrase.
Yes.
All of your examples about the post-depression focused on the ability of us working people to manufacture and make things and have jobs that are made things. How do you recreate that when we don't make anything anymore?
Well, the verb to make is a loaded verb because most stuff that is physical that we buy, the actual physical aspects of what we buy are the smallest value added in what we buy. Most of the value added comes in engineering and design engineering, manufacturing engineering, system integration, distribution, marketing, advertising, finance and legal services. It's on and on and on. They are classified, most of them, as services, but that's the value. I mean, this cell phone in my pocket, which is a very archaic form of cell phone, it's not an iPhone, it's just a simple cell phone, most of this is not the value that what I paid for is not the physical manifestation of this. And people who want to go back to a manufacturing economy are not focusing on a second fact, and that is that manufacturing today is not nearly as labor-intensive as the old assembly lines. I was visiting a manufacturing facility not that long ago in the Midwest, and I went in, and it was mostly numerically controlled machine tools and robotics, and only 10 or 15 people sitting behind computers controlling all of them. It's a different world. We can't go back there. Well, the transition is really a transition over the long term to a higher educated workforce capable of solving and identifying new problems, of being more creative, of doing the kind of advanced service work that we need in the globe. It doesn't mean everybody has to do that, but a larger portion of us have to be doing that. The rest of the jobs will inevitably be in the local service economy, the retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, all of the things that require personal attention, child care, elder care. I mean, there's going to be a lot of that. But my point is that unless we have a critical percentage of our population, much larger than now, capable of doing the complicated engineering, design, creative work that the new economy, global economy, is paying for, all our standard of living just will not be able to hold. Yes.
I'm with you 100% about this sort of the examples of rejuvenation throughout American history. So I'm always amazed about the Jamestown colony, for example, where you'd be born to two biological parents, and then your mother would die of malaria, and your father would remarry, and then your father would die, and your stepmother would remarry. Most people would graduate from into adulthood with parents who weren't their biological parents, and yet that colony was able to thrive in really remarkable ways. And I think about your point, like if you were to sort of focus on what are those key factors that allow sort of that rejuvenation. You may think in the 20th century about the muckraking journalists in the turn of the century, maybe the unions in the 30s, but what's the new progressive era? What's the outline of that? What's the moving force behind it?
I don't know.
Thank you.
No, one thing that I love about teaching at the Goldman School is that there are so many students, as Thiel said, who embody so much enthusiasm and so much energy and so much originality and creativity in terms of tackling the problems of the world. If I were going to ask myself, what is it that is the new model? I can't tell what it is. I can't describe it to you, but I know it's there and it's among these young people. And that's what gives me great confidence. Honestly.
You mentioned a few of the public policy initiatives in the 1930s that you credited with a great deal of success later. And so I was wondering, beyond carbon tax, what the recommendations are for public policy for now.
Well, I kind of divide the world of public policy and the kind of next economy into two pieces. One has to do with the short term. How do we, in the relatively short term, ensure that there's enough aggregate demand in our society that in turn will generate jobs? We can't just give money willy-nilly to people. But what can we do to perhaps through expanding the earned income tax code, credit rather, making it move right all the way through into the middle class, maybe exempting the first $20,000 of income from the payroll tax, making it up by applying the payroll tax to much higher incomes. There are a whole variety of things that could be done that would, in the short term, put more money into people's pockets and generate, therefore, through a multiplier effect, more economic activity, growth, and jobs. But then we get to the longer term, which is, in some sense, much more important. And I keep on coming back to the theme we were just talking about, and that is education. We know, for example, that early childhood education works. Very rarely in social science literature do we have so much evidence pointing to the success and importance of particular initiatives in terms of the return to public investment as we do with early childhood education. For example, we also know something, although less, about K through 12 education, about how to make it work, what's working and what's not working. And finally, the thing that is most distressing to me is that we know that more and more of our young people who are qualified need to be able to afford a college degree when, in fact, we're heading in exactly the opposite direction, as fast as we possibly can. The University of California at Berkeley is still the best public university in America, probably the world. But what is happening to it is an example of us, as Californians as Americans, collectively shooting ourselves in the feet. It is insane. It is irrational. And to a smaller degree, but no less, metaphorically, the Goldman School is a jewel, a crown jewel, and needs many, many more resources. So I ask all of you, this is what I was really building up toward. When you do get the extension of the Bush tax cut, I take that extension of the Bush tax cut and turn it around and give it to Henry. Thank you very much.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
That was Aftershock with Robert Wright. And now, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the element during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations, Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses. Development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture. A dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine, Tambourine's calling to me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine, man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning I come by. Empire as it returned into sand, and it's from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I'm branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song with me. In the jingle jangle morning I come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped, my hands can't feel the grip, my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere, I'm ready for TV. Into my own parade, cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song with me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song with me. In the jingle jangle morning I come following you. Mm-hmm. smokings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, far to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. There's to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sand, with all memory fade, living deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about the day until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine, man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you.
And now for something completely different.